When was your last checkup? No, not you. Although that's important, too. But when was your last vehicle checkup? When it comes to service, nobody knows your Chevy better than your local Chevy dealer. Chevy Drive Chicago. Schedule a service appointment at your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer.
All right, now it's 12:11, and here's Elise Glink. She regularly joins us on Mondays as the owner of Think Glink Media, the publisher of the Substack Love, Money, and Real Estate. And you can find that on Substack and, of course, thinklink.com. Hi, Elise. How are you?
I'm good, John. How are you?
Give me some good household financial news.
Well, I don't know if this is good, but we've had a record level for America's household debt. It's now $18.8 trillion.
Well, that's terrible news.
It is. It's not great. It's about $154,000 and change per person. And
wait,
worse than
say that,
that
again? What are you talking about?
Well, if you divide the total amount of debt that we have by the number of households that we have.
Oh, you're talking about the federal national debt.
I'm not talking about the national debt.
Oh.
The government owes $39 trillion more. That's about $288,000 per person.
Oh.
What I'm talking about is personal debt. How much debt American households are now carrying.
And how much is it?
It's $18.8 trillion, or about $154,000 per person.
Well, I'm listening to the show that we're doing here, but I'm having trouble getting my head around that because credit card debt is like around $7,000 or $14,000 or something like that.
Credit card debt's $1.28 trillion. It's up 5.5% year over year. It is about, oh, I think about $6,000 per person on its own, but it is, and mortgages do make up the vast majority of this.
There it is. There's the nut.
But,
I mean, okay,
right.
Fine. But still, that's I think you could almost subtract that out, though, because otherwise this number's crazy scary.
Yeah, it is really
that's
crazy.
That's an appreciating asset. That's not depreciating.
Well, for most of us, it is.
In theory.
Right. So I think one of the things that you want to really focus on, though, is that this total debt number is starting to cause some issues in the housing market. And that's what I wanted to talk to you about today. FHA mortgage delinquency. So FHA, Federal Housing Authority, these are mortgages typically made to our first-time buyers, to people who have not great credit, people who have a little bit lower income levels. But mortgage delinquencies for FHA mortgages are spiking to levels that we haven't seen since 2012.
Hmm. And what's going on here, Elise?
I think what's going on is that people are absolutely pressed to the metal between high gas prices. I mean, you know, yes, in California, it's over $6 a gallon and going higher. But you know what I paid the other day? I was at $5 at Costco.
Yeah.
I paid $4.99 at Costco.
Yeah, it was $4.99 over the weekend, and it wasn't a Costco, but it was at a cheap local place, $4.99.
Yeah, and I went up to Madison for my niece's graduation. I had to fill up there also. I paid $4.50 in Wisconsin. So we've got high prices at the grocery stores. We've got high prices at our gas stations where all that debt that people are carrying is now rising interest rates, so you're not paying, you know, 5% on your credit card debt anymore, you might be paying 15 to 20%. All of that is really pinching people, especially those first-time buyers and people with a little bit lower maybe credit or lower income. And the FHA delinquency rate is pretty serious. It's up 11.5%, which is up 0.75% in a single quarter of the year, in a three-month period. And that's stress. You're just talking about financial stress up and down the line for people.
What about the April home prices? What happened there?
So the April home prices went up, and they went up in a lot of different places. So the National Association of Realtors also released their April existing home sales report. So it went up about 0.2%. The national median price, $417,700. That's up almost 1% from a year ago, kind of flat year over year, but it's the 34th consecutive month of year over year price increases. So what we're seeing is over the past 3 years, month after month, home prices are going up, which makes affordability a problem, right, for anybody who's trying to get into the picture.
Well, yeah.
And especially in Chicago, which we talked about last week, I think we have we're now at the ninth fastest home price increases in the country.
Well, is that a good, I guess that's a good thing and a bad thing. It's not great if you're a buyer, but if you're a seller, I mean, I think we want to champion rising home prices, don't we? That's a good thing, right?
Well, we do, within reason. So, for example, in Milwaukee, their home prices are up 6%. That's the annual growth rate. They're number 3 in the country. We're number 9 right now in the country. Our home prices are up 4.9%, which is, yes, do we want home prices to go up? Absolutely. Like, I want mine to go up. You want yours to go up.
Yep.
But it's going up quite quickly in the north and in the east, whereas home prices are falling down in the south and the southwest, where they had been increasing. And for Chicagoans, this is nice because for years we've been at the very bottom of home price appreciation. You and I have talked about this too. But when it goes up so quickly, so you just want to be careful because that may not last.
It's outpacing inflation. So your home is appreciating at a rate greater than your money is decreasing. That's a good thing, too. Not by a lot, but it is.
Yeah.
Right?
No, absolutely. I mean, it is going faster than inflation. Remember that inflation is up quite a bit, 3.5% now on an annual basis. But if you look at the producer price increase, the last number that I saw was about 4.5%.
Yeah.
So what you're seeing is this acceleration of inflation. And the property prices we're seeing are all reflective of that. So historically, home prices have increased just at above the rate of inflation. So if inflation is at 3.5%, our home prices are increasing at, say, 5%. That's a little bit more than just a little bit. Overall, nationwide, though, most places are seeing that decrease a little bit. I hope that means that inflation's going to go down, but I don't know, given what's going on with the oil and gas prices.
Is the Fed's target still 2% for?
It is. Yeah. 2.5%. That hasn't changed. How they get there, though, they're going to have to be very careful. I don't anticipate, and neither do any economists right now, that the federal funds rate will go down, simply because if it does, it'll juice the economy further, and inflation will probably, likely, I'm not a fortune teller, but likely, when you do that, the inflation number goes up, and nobody wants that to happen.
Stay right there. We're visiting with Elise Glink, Think Link Media, on the Noon Business Lunch. We're talking to Elise Glink from Think Link Media here on the Noon Business Lunch. Hey, John Williams, not everyone has credit card debt or bills that are out of control. I can attest to the fact that I live within my pension and I don't buy things I can't afford. I save money and am careful about what I buy at the grocery store. I put my kids through college without loans and they all graduated on the dean's list. It is possible to do. No, it's not. No, it's not. It was, God bless you, and I'm sure it wasn't easy, but I reject that categorically. I'm happy for you. I'm happy for you. But I try not to judge other people's failure in light of my fortunate circumstances sometimes. I don't know. Do you have something to say about that?
I think the key word in that is pension, right? And so, you know, the vast majority of people had pensions prior to the 1980s when 401ks were introduced. And pensions are wonderful. They're guaranteed income. It's kind of like Social Security. You get it every month, no matter what, for the rest of your life, and maybe your spouse gets it after that. A lot of people don't have that today. In fact, most people don't. And so when you talk about putting your kids through and raising a family and all that, the kind of future retirement income that you had, which was Social Security plus a pension, just isn't there. And so more and more people have to plan for that. And things are a lot more expensive, relatively speaking, than they used to be.
Yeah. I want to acknowledge what that person said, though, in a more favorable light. There is a swell of people who aren't paying attention and either aren't working hard enough or aren't saving hard enough. I was listening to the news this morning on the way in, and they were talking about how many people make impulse buys. I see tattoos on arms of people sometimes, and I think you should have put that in an IRA. But people probably we have a lot of people in this country who aren't managing their money well. But I also think that the circumstances for people are so varied. And for some people, it isn't so easy or simple. So I don't know what I'm saying. I don't know what the solution to all that is. But I try not to judge other people's failings by my good fortune. That's all.
I think that's exactly right. And I have a lot of compassion for people who are trying to buy houses, who are trying to better themselves, who are saving money, who want to get in the stock market or have gotten into the stock market. It's very, very difficult to get ahead. You have to start somewhere, and you have to start on today. It's a perfect day to just keep putting one foot in front of the other.
What did you say about the employment situation? What did the April numbers show?
The numbers look pretty good. There were 115,000 jobs added. The unemployment level held steady at 4.3. A little bit of a concern was the U6, which is the broadest measure of unemployment, includes people who have already stopped looking up. That's about 8.6%, so that's a little bit high. The chief economist of the Mortgage Bankers Association, Mike Fredantoni, he's a really smart guy. You know, he called out in one of his updates today that the three-month average of jobs created is only 48,000 jobs. It's not 115,000. The prior months have had a revision downgrade. And so that means that basically instead of getting these big numbers that we get, you have to go back over the past 3 months and take a look at what, you know, they've found since they revised the numbers. The jobs are being concentrated in healthcare, social assistance, retail, trade, and transportation. The federal government, this number surprised me, John, federal government employment has shed almost 350,000 jobs since October of 2024. That's down 11.5%. And the labor force participation rate, the number of people actually working, 61.8%, the lowest since November of 2021.
Elise Glink writes and talks about this stuff in her Substack, Love, Money, and Real Estate. ThinkGlink.com is her website. Okay, Elise, another week. We'll do it again. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, John.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
This is the Noon Business Lunch. You're listening to WGN. Neil Fisher's our producer today. This is John Williams. One of our listeners texted in and said, I just read an article stating that the University of Michigan stands to earn $2 billion, two with a B, billion dollars on their investment in early AI. This investment was made with endowment money. Can you speak to that with some of your experts sometime? I was unaware that endowment dollars are invested this way. We do know there are strings attached to a lot of endowment dollars. That's why, say, a Harvard or whatever is sometimes not able to do the things you'd want them to do, University of Illinois for that matter, because the money is held in a way that doesn't make it as spendable as maybe the universities or some of us would like. I did click around and do see several stories supporting this, though. Wow. I wonder if our next guest knows much about that. Jim Dahlke, are you there?
Hey, John. Yes, I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Jim Dahlke is the director of communications at TechNexus Venture Collaborative. I wonder if in other words, do they put money in Anthropic or something like that, or what? I'm not exactly sure what that means. Do you?
Yeah, you know, the most likely scenario here is that they were an investor, a limited partner in a VC fund that invested in the AI startup. So when VC funds go out to raise, you know, capital, and university endowments are one of the sources that they will often turn to, in addition to corporations and family offices and other sort of wealthy folks. But yeah, university endowments can certainly, you know, play a role in the tech ecosystem, as they're often investors within the venture capital funds that go out and find the startups to invest in.
I never thought about that. I mean, those are massive pools of money at some of these schools. And you know what I was alluding to is sometimes the rising cost of inflation or tuition. Some kids can't afford it, and we complain about that. They say, why don't they just give some of that money to the students? But sometimes it's earmarked in a way that doesn't allow that. But evidently, it can be used to be invested, hopefully wisely. And in this case, it paid off for Michigan, huh?
Yeah, you know, what we're seeing right now is, you know, all of these major AI companies head towards an IPO, and, you know, employees kind of start to sell their shares. It is a major wealth event that is happening for folks that are backing these companies, both the investors, you know, the endowments and the other LPs that are in these venture funds that have shares of these fast-growing AI startups, and then the employees themselves. You know, headlines in the San Francisco Bay Area right now are all about how the housing market is getting even nuttier than it already is, because lots of, for example, OpenAI employees were able to sell some shares recently and are certainly flush with cash. So it's going to be wild times as a lot of these very heavily venture-backed, very highly valued AI companies head to the public market.
Do you know how many AI or generative AI, what would be the word, apps or bots are out there? How many of those exist? It's hundreds, right?
Oh, certainly. I mean, starting at the top, though, you know, the real kind of LLM players, these large language models, there aren't as many of those, but there are hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of businesses that have, you know, these LLM models baked into their own technologies that they've you know, created businesses around. You know, I've sat through presentations where different AI experts will say that there's, you know, the latest count is 35,000 AI startups that have, you know, new services they're trying to sell you. And so there's quite a bit of money actually to be made right now in helping people understand the AI landscape and the tools that are actually worth using. You know, we're seeing people leave all different kind of fields in venture and AI right now to kind of specifically help large corporations and their employees figure out the landscape of different AI tools and what's actually worth using.
Yeah, we've started on a tangent here. I will make one other point about this. The Daily podcast from the New York Times today talks about the difference between artificial intelligence as it's being developed or allowed to be evolved in China versus in the United States. They're more restrictive there because of political concerns, and China controls everything. It's very top down. The United States is a more organic playing field. They did say that the advantage China has is that they are on task. They, 10 years ago, said, okay, we're going to use artificial intelligence to make very specific components of our lives better. Driverless taxis, factory automation, you know, real nuts and bolts, tactile, hands-on things you can feel every day. Whereas the United States has been maybe the place where generative AI evolves, and that's, you know, more mind-blowing, if you will, but less concrete right now. Both countries might advertise that they have the advantage, but if you said in what country are the lives of people being impacted and impacted more positively by, it's China. In China, they don't fear AI. They go, it's great. One example, they said there is a mask that people put on their face, sort of like the mask Batman might wear just over his nose and eyes. And it's a translation mask. So then the Chinese mother will say to the Chinese child, how are you today? But the mask will now say it in English, even though the mother doesn't speak English. But this is how you train your children. You put the mask on and then you talk to them all day in your Chinese tongue, Mandarin, whatever they speak. But it will come out as English, and then you hear the child responding as they are learning English. How about all of that?
It's fascinating, right? And I think that, you know, part of the problem that AI has in the U.S., it's got a very negative perception generally, right? And yes. I think it's because perhaps of the approach that we've taken, where we've kind of focused on the large language model piece of it rather than those kind of very specific everyday use cases. I mean, AI, if you are a computer engineer, is an unbelievable transformation for how you work, right? If you create, you know, art and copy, you know, for a business, and you're able to generate images and generate content, it's amazing what it can do. But there aren't that many kind of everyday use cases for you know, the broad swath of the American population outside of, you know, just a really good beefed up search engine, right? So some of those kind of specific everyday examples that I think will come, you know, especially right with driverless cars. We're already seeing that, yeah, you know, in the Bay Area, in Los Angeles. That's expanding everywhere. And but a lot of people, you know, haven't had an opportunity to interact with it, so they're not seeing it day in and day out.
You go to China and ask their version of ChatGPT, tell me about Tiananmen Square. It doesn't know. Okay, let's talk a little bit about Spot Hero here in Chicago. What's the story here, Jim?
Yeah, you know, we talked about the acquisition from Uber earlier this year. Spot Hero is a parking app based here in Chicago, 15 years old. Actually got to start in our offices here at TechNexus. And we got news last week of the actual acquisition price. So Uber mentioned in an SEC filing that it paid $600 million for Spot Hero, which is, hey, a really nice acquisition for a company that, you know, during the pandemic saw its revenue basically almost go down to zero. So Spot Hero is an app that lets you find parking and pay for parking, you know, in hundreds of cities across the U.S. and in Canada as well. And, you know, obviously with COVID and, you know, nobody going to work, you know, their revenue absolutely plummeted. So really kind of a story of resilience here. This is a company born in Chicago, stayed in Chicago, weathered the storm, and came out on the other side with a $600 million acquisition from a company like Uber. So a really great bow on a really impressive story of entrepreneurship right here in Chicago.
A New York startup is opening an office in Chicago. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, we've been talking a lot about kind of large companies, you know, opening up Midwest offices, you know, Databricks, for example, the cryptocurrency company Ripple. This is a smaller company, but still a good news for Chicago. The company is called InstaSwitch. They are a fintech startup that helps small businesses switch their banks. So think if they've got, you know, to move payroll or income and different vendors, they're able to kind of switch banks effortlessly. And this is a company that's based in New York City, but is going to open a Chicago office after raising some new funding from one of their investors, including Chicago Ventures right here in town. So a great little example of a smaller company able to open up a Chicago office. And, you know, they say that they really see a lot of fintech talent here in Chicago, so that we've known for a long time. There's a lot of financial technology, you know, experts and leaders and engineers right here in Chicago, and InstaSwitch sees that as well.
Good to hear, and good to hear Jim Dahlke, Director of Communications, TechNexus Venture Collaborative. TechNexus is their website. Nice to talk to you, Jim. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks, John.
Mike Spriggs joins us again, the head of Consumer Insights at Fiserv, as we look at how small businesses in Chicago and the Chicago area are doing. Hi, Mike. Welcome back. And how are we doing?
Hey, doing pretty good. We're trying to keep pace in Chicago with all of the price hikes that are happening across retail and across services. It's really starting to put pressure on consumers. We see the same trends happening nationally. And so, you know, consumers are just going to have to kind of roll with the punches here.
Are we any different here than they are in other parts of the country? How does Chicago compare to Atlanta or someplace?
Yeah. Chicago's numbers kind of mirror the U.S. and mirror other big cities, like you just mentioned, Atlanta. Overall, Chicago's year-over-year sales in small business were relatively flat, just about a tenth of a point growth over the same month last year. Transactions were down, and this is a recurring theme I'll dig into a little bit for you. Transactions were down about a half point, and as a result, average tickets we see are starting to climb, not only in Chicago, but across the U.S. And consumers, like in other major cities across the U.S., they seem to be saying with how they're behaving that, you know, this is just starting to be too much. And are trying to find ways to bring it down. And what we've been watching is how foot traffic or transactions is starting to taper and thin out as consumers look for ways to kind of mitigate how much they're spending every month. And we see that in Chicago as well.
Well, the prices have been higher because of fuel, but that's been for the last 8 weeks. I guess it's 11 weeks now. But I presume then this is going to continue, because I would imagine that the first few weeks of the war in Iran, the numbers weren't even factored in. They weren't an issue yet. It's only of late that the prices have gone way up.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a spot-on observation. And what we're seeing across the U.S., Chicago certainly as a microcosm, is that consumers are starting to try to figure out ways to to compensate for this increase in an essential spend that they're making. And so we've seen these trade-offs happening with foot traffic in other areas. I'll give you some examples. And certainly in areas where there's discretionary spend, a lot of that has kind of thinned out. But in particular in retail, we've seen food and beverage foot traffic come down about 5% in the Chicagoland area. Restaurant foot traffic is down 6.5% year on year for the month of April in the Chicago area. And so these things are not only, you know, impacting total sales for those areas, but also showing evidence that consumers are kind of putting those dollars into gas purchase.
Hmm. That's interesting. And I know this is anecdotal, but I go to the store, or I go to restaurants, and it seems to me like they're pretty busy still. We've attributed that maybe to the top of the K economy, but you're telling me that these numbers don't lie. Overall, retail down 5 and restaurant down 6.5% now.
Yeah, in foot traffic. Now, you know, some of that in terms of sales dollars, some of that is being made up by higher average tickets. And so the decline in sales may not be as evident as the decline that we're seeing in transactions.
Yeah. Well, I wonder what the retailer would prefer. A small business wants money more than they want feet, right?
Well, it depends. And if you're in a high velocity category like restaurants, you really thrive on customer traffic in and out that door, because you also have to compete on the best price available, right, to outperform your competition. So the foot traffic is really what's important for some of those businesses.
Yeah. Last note about this trend then. Chicago's usually when you come on, tell us that year over year and month over month, we're doing better than most of the country. Is that still true overall?
Hey, yeah, still true overall. But what we're seeing through the Fiserv Small Business Index, we're tracking about 2 million small businesses across the U.S., is that overall the picture says consumers are starting to slow down a little bit as they grapple with these stubbornly high prices. And Chicago is no exception.
Mike Spriggs is the head of consumer insights at Fiserv. Fiserv.com is the website. Mike, we always appreciate you checking in. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.